Hello, well, welcome to the last lecture of term. Amazing that you've reached the end of your first term at university and think of all the books you've read and how much more you know as a result. I went onto Amazon today and was looking at living, and it said that people who enjoyed this book also bought Edward Thomas's poems, W. Somerset Maugham's short stories, Portrait of the Artist's Young Man and the Iliad, and I thought to myself, I wonder why. and I also thought, I wonder what people who've enjoyed living would make of being directed to those books. And that's an interesting question in itself, I guess. I'm also at the moment sort of thinking a bit about the Warwick Prize for Writing. I wonder if somebody could shut that door. I don't know whether it makes any difference, but... which has a theme this year, which always has a theme, and the theme this year is colour. And one of the books that's been long listed is a book called What Colour is the Sacred by Michael Tausig. And I've only just started reading it, and it's very an interesting multicultural disquisition on colour and how we use it and don't use it socially. And like a lot of books that range hugely widely, it makes generalizations that you find yourself disagreeing with. One of the things he says about Western culture in relation to color, part of his point is it taken from Goethe, and it is that in Western culture, we're suspicious of color. We use it as for sort of splashes, a painting on a wall, or a particular garment, a scarf or something. But on the whole, we go for subdued colours. We wear grey and dark blue and black. And looking around the room, I can see one or two notable exceptions. But, you know, the picture holds. But then he said, well, we paint our walls cream and not bright colours. And then I come in here and I think, well, that doesn't really hold in here. Anyway, he has a lot of interesting things to say, but he quotes a letter that Virginia Woolf wrote to Vanessa Bell, her sister, who was a painter, in 1938, and she's in the Isle of Skye in Scotland, and Virginia Woolf writes, one should be a painter, a theme that, as you know from To the Lighthouse, she's very caught up in. As a writer, she says, I feel the beauty, which is almost entirely colour, very subtle, very changeable, running over my pen as if you poured a large jug of champagne over a hairpin. It's kind of fantastically vivid and kind of quirky response to the Isle of Skye. But it did strike me that in all the different things we talk about and try to link on this module, the relation of the visual arts in this period to literature and the crossover between painting and writing, it doesn't get enough attention. I'm not going to be talking about that today, but just thinking to myself about, I will be talking about visual aspects of living. And I was thinking, does colour come into it? And immediately turned to the end of the first chapter. Evening was spring. This is at the works manager's house. Heavy blue clouds stayed over above. In small back garden of villa, small tree was with yellow buds. On table in back room, daffodils faded, were between ferns in a vase. Already colour comes into it. And one of the things that Green is very interested in living is the aspects of beauty which come into the lives of the working people that he's writing about. And I think there's if we're thinking about links between him and other writers we've been thinking about this term, William Carlos Williams is one who could usefully be brought in, partly because of Green's almost voyeuristic attention to everyday objects and the way he pauses on them and focuses on them. And you think back to William Carlos Williams's young woman in an apron looking into her shoe for a loose nail, or the crowd at a ball game. Think about that in relation to Henry Green and the Aston Villa game. The old man gathering dog lime, the famous red wheelbarrow. Those are images of kinds that come into Green's narrative. And another link between them, I think, is the sense of a gap, not only between actuality and dream, but between different experiences, the gappiness itself of experience, its fragmentariness. William Carlos Williams says it is only in isolate flecks that something is given off, that is in To Elsie. And Henry Green's novel has a great deal in common with that aesthetic, I think, although it also does things that William Carlos Williams doesn't do. I don't think Green ever met Williams or knew anything about him, and there's no reason to think that he had read him, although he did read William Faulkner, and admired him. So he was interested in experimentation in American literature of his time. But the point of linking them is not to say there's this influence from one on the other, but to say clearly there is a kind of aesthetic around. There's a zeitgeist. There's a feeling in the world that these things need to be thought about, and Green is responding to it in his own way. I want today to try and draw together some of the threads we've been thinking about in relation to literature in the modern world and fiction in the modern world, obviously, basically, by way of setting Green in context. And the first thing, perhaps, I should stress, and it's illustrated on the handout, is the coexistence, and I keep coming back to this, but I think it is terribly important that when we're thinking about pressures, movements, directions, tendencies, at any given time, one needs to remember that a lot of different things go on at the same time. And on the first page of this handout, I've tried to give you a kind of timeline from the beginning to the middle of the 20th century, I suppose, indicating a number of writers who, on the left-hand side, are clearly modernist in the sense that they're responding to and directing their attention to the modern world around them, and also finding new ways of interpreting it and new stylistic ways of responding to it. And on the right-hand side, very crudely divided, are writers who, on the other hand, are much more traditional in their approach to style and handling, although in different ways they themselves, in content, are responding to their time. It's just a way, I hope, of giving you some kind of things to hang on to as I talk, because some of these names will come in. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say is already now familiar to you, but just to sort of summarize some things, what are the new features of this period? Well, in both poetry and fiction, there is an intense effort towards technical innovation, not by everybody, but by a number of writers. And it'll be clear to you from your reading of Living that Henry Green is one of those writers who's interested in finding actually a new way of getting it down onto the page. There's also the question of the gap between what was perceived as the 19th century novel's dominant concern with plot, which I referred to right at the beginning, I can't remember which lecture I talked about it in, but when I quoted Forster, "Yes, oh dear, yes, the novel must tell a story." A different kind of impetus, which was towards the inner life and the workings of the mind. I want to mention a writer who's not on this list, Robert Louis Stevenson, who said that to him the ideal story would begin on a frosty night with a horseman on a tragic errand rattling with his whip upon the green shutters of the inn at Burford. And you kind of immediately, you can imagine that as the start of a story, and you want to carry on with the story, and you want to read it. The horseman on a tragic errand rattling with his whip on the shutters of the inn at Burford. It's so concrete, it's so urgent, it's so mysterious. But of course there were many other ways of writing, and Henry James, who was a contemporary of Stevenson's, Stevenson, born in 1850, Henry James, 1843. So, kind of a bit older than Freud, and a generation or two older than the writers on this page that I've given you otherwise. So, if you think about your own relation to the writers of your own time, Stevenson stood in relation to Henry Green as perhaps Ian McEwan to your generation, or Toni Morrison. So somebody who's up there very distinctly up there, but you know, quite a senior figure, and you're trying to do something which may learn from them, but is going to be different. Now, Stevenson was a friend of Henry James, and James was interested in the minutiae of interactions between people and the minutiae of how the mind worked, although he approached that in a less complex and idiosyncratic way than Virginia Woolf or Henry Green. And the two men argued a lot about what should be written about. And James was arguing about individual psychology and the imagination. And Stevenson, at that point, was getting more and more interested in the factual world outside himself. He'd gone to Western Samoa. If ever there was a world of color, it was that. Stevenson was living in the South Pacific. But when he went there, you would think, as a number of artists, other artists did, Gauguin, for example, and later Somerset Maugham, he actually got very interested in and caught up in the politics of the island and how the communities living there were being affected by imperialism, by missionaries, and by warships that were moored off the coast, American, French, German, British, and the rivalries between what were called the great powers and how they were impacting in that place. And there's a clear link, of course, with Maugham's story, Rain, just in terms of location, as well as in other aspects. I mean, the attempt by outside forces, missionaries, to correct how people were living. And Stevenson was saying, you know, the real world is so staggeringly important and powerful that there's no point in making anything up. This is the Stevenson who started out writing romance and adventure fiction. And James Joyce was appalled at this attitude and was trying to argue his friend out of it. Now, James was an influence on and was influenced by movements in philosophy and psychology which came to a particularly dramatic culmination in the work of Freud, who I think we can think of as an imaginative writer in the sense that his interpretation of how the mind worked was no more sort of concretely, objectively experimental than an imaginative writer's, and indeed many of his examples come from literature. But through that influence was coming this emphasis on the novel of the mind and of mental process. And that was more important in prose than it was in poetry. And the chronology of the texts as they appeared in English is set out on this handout. I won't spell it out because there wouldn't be time, but you can see the kind of potential interactions that are going on there. Now, Henry Green is a latecomer in terms of the modernism that we've been talking about this term. And can I once again stress the distinction I tried to make in the first week between the modern, which is a kind of involuntary period-based phenomenon. You are modern to yourself. You may live in whatever world you live in is for you modern. You don't have any choice about it. And modernist, which it represents a kind of wish to be something which is expressly and strongly modern. So that you can be a modern writer without being modernist. Modernist implies a choice and being part of a positive, positively responding reaction to the modern. Green had that wish. He came later than the writers you've been looking at this term, but he overlapped with them. His books, not his first books, but from 1929 on, he was published, from 1939 on, I'm sorry, he was published by the Hogarth Press, which was run by Virginia Woolf and her husband. He knew both of them well. But he's on the cusp between an increasing feeling in the late 20s and especially in the 30s, at the cusp between the earlier focus on the individual and the pressures on the individual, which you get in poetry as well as in prose, and an increasing feeling in the late 20s and the 30s that society and the whole predicament of people living together had to be thought about, and particularly the predicament of people who had no money, whose jobs were at risk, people living as we are today in a time of deep economic uncertainty, mounting unemployment, and grotesque divisions between the lives of the rich and the poor, the factory owners and the factory workers. So that Henry Green is trying to do something that simultaneously responds in an accepting, depicting way to the world he encounters as he encounters it, and yet who has a moral, even a political pressure lying behind his work. That's a complicated statement. Well, it's not a complicated statement, but it's complicated because it's untrue. I don't want you to think of Henry Green as a propagandist writer, a writer with a cause, a simple message. He was much, much more divided and ambivalent and instinctive than that. He wasn't an intellectual writer. He certainly wasn't a socialist. But he did have a very, very strong satirical response to the world he grew up in. And I'll come back to that. As well as a human responsiveness to ordinariness. Virginia Woolf famously said, examine an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. And a question often asked about Virginia Woolf is, did she follow her own advice? Are there any ordinary people, ordinary minds on ordinary days in Virginia Woolf? Well, there certainly are in Henry Green. So, to retrace, and then I'll come back to where I am at the moment, the thingness of things in themselves, which William Carlos Williams responds to, trying to get things down as they are without surrounding them with meaning or plot, something very much that was there in the writing of a previous generation to Greens. Gertrude Stein I've put down. I've wanted to mention some people you haven't come across on the syllabus, because I think it's terribly important that syllabuses are aware of what's not on them as well as what is. For practical reasons, there's only so much you can read, but it's important not to think that's all there is. Gertrude Stein, she's there, famously said, rose is a rose is a rose. Rose is a rose is a rose. You don't need to do anything with it. And on the handout, I've given you a quotation on the other page of the handout, the back of the handout, where she said, I had to feel, there's some quotations, the first one, I had to feel anything and everything that for me was existing so intensely that I could put it down in writing as a thing in itself, without at all necessarily using its name. You can work out what you think she means for yourselves. But it's a short step from words in themselves, things in themselves, to language and the relation of writers to language. And one of the problems with modernism in one of the directions it would go was that in becoming deeply caught up with its own processes, its own self-referentiality, it cut itself off from ordinary readers and cut itself off from an engagement with the immediate surroundings, that we naturally tend to want our arts to engage with. And the classic example of that is James Joyce, who in Dubliners writes what could be mistaken for quite conventional late 19th, early 20th century short stories, who then goes on to become more experimental in Portrait of the Artist, even more so in Ulysses, and then in 1939 publishes Finnegan's Wake, which begins in the middle of a sentence and ends with the which begins in the middle of a sentence and ends with the first half of that sentence, so that you have to go right back to the beginning and start again. And who had the idea that people would spend their lives reading it round and round and round and never read anything else and spend their whole time trying to work out what it meant? You should look at Finnegan's Wake to get an idea of the fun of it and the cleverness of it. It's a brilliant, extraordinary piece of wordplay, but also completely incomprehensible. Now, Henry Greene represents, it seems to me, a turning point away from that. He's still trying to push language and experiment and storytelling into new forms and new structures. But at the same time, he's saying, hang on, what is happening in the world out there, and let's try and depict it. Now, Greene has not been very much written about, as you'll find if you go to the library, though there is more and more work being done on him now, and I think he's going to be taught more and more as a result. But let me give you some background. You can see that he's a generation younger than Joyce, Kafka, and Woolf. His name is a pseudonym. His real name was Henry York. He had this in common with George Orwell, who we'll come on to next term, whose real name was Eric Blair. Both these writers were educated at Eton, and they were contemporaries there. And at some level felt that they had to take on a new identity, free from their class background and its privileges, in order to write about the kinds of thing that they wanted to write about. Both of them realized that the privileges they had enjoyed could not exist without having been taken, in some sense, from other people. That there was a finite amount of wealth, and if some people had a lot of it, it naturally meant that others had to have less of it. They both wanted to know what it was like not to be themselves, which is, if you like, one of the key impulses of the imaginative artist. What would it be not to be me? And in their cases, they both of them empirically set about finding out what it would be not to be them by going and living rough. George Orwell took odd jobs and lived in homeless people's shelters, and wrote about those things in a couple of his books, Down and Out in Paris and London particularly. And Henry Greene left university early and went to work on the shop floor of a factory in South Birmingham on the Grand Union Canal. Now, he'd already established himself as somebody who wanted above all to be a writer. His novel Blindness, which he'd begun at school, was published while he was a student at Oxford. It appeared while he was still a student. There's also something intrinsically laughable about his experiment of going and living in working men's lodgings and working in an iron foundry in Birmingham for 2 years, which is that the firm belonged to his father. So that from one point of view, what he was doing was working his way up from the shop floor in a way that might have been thought to be what somebody should do in a business, though his dad certainly hadn't done that. And from another point of view, he was, of course, still just as privileged as he always had been. The fact that he was living in working men's lodgings didn't mean that he couldn't go home at the weekend, if he felt like it, to the grand country house in Herefordshire, near Tewkesbury, in Gloucestershire rather, where his parents lived. But I'm sure that it was extremely tough for Henry York to do what he did, partly because it wasn't expected, partly because the people he was working with couldn't make out what was going on. They assumed that he'd done something very bad, and so his father was punishing him by making him work with them. But he really, really worked hard at integrating himself with them. Again, he got very interested in football. He went to the movies a lot. He went out with the men drinking. he did a physical job that was an arduous physical job for a couple of years, and then he put what he found out into Living. And the important thing about Living, I think, or among the important things about Living, are first of all that his depiction of the people he was working with have that element of empirical fact. It's possible for him to talk about the responsiveness of working people and their families to beauty, for example, without patronizingness and without sentimentality, because of the freshness and quirkiness of what he actually saw. And secondly, what he's able to do, and the traditional novel of working class life, as written, for example, by Zola, attempts to do this. It'll give you pictures, and Galsworthy does this too, will give you pictures of the owning class and the working class and juxtapose them. But Green had a particularly inward and satirical sense of how the ruling class actually operated. I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, I said, I reminded you earlier that one of the big influences on fiction of this period and a bit earlier was Freud. Another was Marx. And again, as with William Carlos Williams, and I think Freud too, I don't think Henry Green read a word of Marx. I don't suppose he read a word of Freud either, but he was alert enough to have picked up what was in the air and what people were saying. Marx's understanding of the complex ways in which the rich managed to exploit the poor had a pervasive influence in the society of Green's time, not least through Fabianism and the Labour Party. In 1922, the Labour Party overtook the Liberals as the leading opposition to conservatism. Socialism was in, they didn't come to power for the first time until 1945, the Labour Party, by the way. So socialism was in the air, and Henry Green caught its interests and some of its preoccupations, not only in Living, but in his novel Court, which is set in a London fire station during the Blitz. Green worked as a fireman in the Second World War. And a novel called Loving, which is about a country house in Ireland, but which is entirely seen through the lives and the preoccupations of the servants in that house. Now, in what ways can we see Green as responding to these currents of his time? Well, first of all, from its first words, Living is concerned with one of the most pressing problems, both for political thinkers and for artists, of modernity, which is the sheer number of people that were involved, the sheer fact of urban populations. Thousands came back from dinner along the streets. That's a kind of refrain running right through the early pages, isn't it? Thousands came back to factories they worked in. Thousands came up the road to work. How can literature communicate the sheer number of lives that are involved in those thousands? It's a moral and political problem as well as an imaginative one. And you can hear an echo there of what Engels wrote, which is on the, one of the things Engels wrote, in the condition of the working class in England in 1845. That's the second quote on the second page of the handout. Hundreds and thousands of men and women drawn from all classes and ranks of society pack the streets. Are they not all human beings with the same innate characteristics and potentialities, all equally interested in the pursuit of happiness? Yet they rush past one another as if they had nothing in common. Living could almost be the novelization of Engels's perception there. Now, some critics have suggested that a characteristic of modernism, literary modernism in particular, is the writer's fear of the masses, to use that terminology. John Carey has suggested this in a book called The Intellectuals and the Masses, and there's plenty of evidence for that. in the work particularly of D.H. Lawrence and Wyndham Lewis and many others, that there's a desperate stress on the brilliant, powerful or elite individual as against this threatening crowd of people of whom the artist has no grasp. But Green obviously is quite consciously and overtly concerned not only to take the opposite stance, to bring out the individuality of as many individuals as he can, but to confront the problem of how much the imagination can cope with in terms of numbers of individuals. So the first 26 pages of Living introduce 26 characters, but they do so in a way that is very confusing, and I think certainly deliberately so. Instead of giving you the names of the characters and some kind of theme tune or descriptive peculiarities by which they'll be remembered, he muddles them up. So although Phil Bridges, the works manager, and Dick Dupre, the owner's son, are going to be central characters throughout, we don't at first know who they are or what they're called. The men in the foundry call the works manager "Tis Him," or "It's Him." That's the sort of nickname they give him. It's a way of warning each other that "It's Him" has just turned up, and so they need to be on the alert. But that is how they routinely talk about him. And they give first names to each other, Albert and Joe, whereas the works manager calls them by their surnames. All that makes the opening pages very, very confusing, but in a way which both corresponds to what life is actually like, meeting a whole lot of people for the first time, and specifically corresponds to what Dick Dupre's experience is, going into the factory and having a new role there, in his case as somebody who's taking over some of the responsibility from his father. So the dense verbal texture is communicating something that's actually empirically important and part of the meaning of the book. Now, there are many other aspects to the style of the book which are difficult and adventurous, and some are successful and some aren't. Particularly the imitation of accent and dialect and the way people spoke and the preoccupations of their speech, and particularly the oddities of speech. And you can explore those, I hope you will, a bit in your seminars. You may also want to look at the way he breaks up his narrative into little units. He himself said that he was trying to replicate in the text something of the way that cutting works in the film. He was very interested in cinema, was kind of addicted to it. When he was a student, he used to spend all day, every day at the cinema, if he possibly could, and he could. Meanwhile, and there's a quite apart from the technical effect of the cinema on his narrative, cinema comes into the text, doesn't it, as a place where people go, and where Green feels as he does, or the novel feels, as it does at the football match. There's a kind of communitarian romance. He describes, I mean, think about it, you know, cinema was a very democratic medium, the most democratic form of entertainment that had come out of the new technology. And he describes everybody in the cinema, over, above, up, into the sky, their feeling, this is page 49 in this edition, over, above, up into the sky, their feeling panted up, supported by each other's feeling, away, away, Europe and America, mass on mass, their feeling united, supporting, renewed their sky. And it's complicated, but at the same time you can get a sort of poetic sense of what it's saying. And if you think about it in relation to some of the other motifs in the book, particularly the homing pigeons going up into the sky, but at some point always coming back, which is a deeply symbolic element of the book, as well as a deeply realistic one, because ordinary people, working people, kept homing pigeons. It was a very common hobby. and also of the aspirations of some of the characters to get away to Australia, to Canada, to wherever, where there'd be a new life, but the fact that none of them does. In that respect, the novel is very Chekhovian, I think, if you know Three Sisters, everybody wanting to get to Moscow, but you know, as in Beckett's Waiting for Godot, they do not move. It's very like that. This sense of how anybody and everybody can have a poetic sense of a world elsewhere, that you don't have to be a poetic character like Stephen Dedalus to think, I must fly by these nets, that anybody can have those feelings, is crucial to the, I think, democratic impulse behind this strange book, as is the way in which Green describes the most ordinary things happening in a domestic situation. Water dripped from tap on wall into basin and into water there. Sun. Water drops made rings in clear colored water. Sun in there shook on the walls and ceiling. As rings went out round, trembling over the water, shadows of light from sun in these trembled on walls, on the ceiling. We all know, we can all imagine that, the sun reflected off an unsettled surface of water in a bowl and sending up those patterns onto the wall or the ceiling. But the point about it is that this is, you know, a working class kitchen. And what Green is saying is that because it's a working class kitchen, it doesn't mean that everybody is all the time terribly oppressed and miserable and life is hell. It's also beautiful. There are these aspects of beauty in it. Now let me move on to one or two other points. This aestheticness was itself something that Green worried about and presented in a characteristically multifaceted way. That's to say, he could see that there could be something precious about that in the negative sense. Dick Dupré has read Ruskin. Ruskin was an aesthetician, an art historian, and also a pioneer of socialist thinking in various ways. He was a great believer in the dignity of labor, the importance of manual labor. But he himself wasn't a laborer. And as Dick Dupré remembers in the novel, Ruskin took a group of students to make a road in Oxford, and they hewed away at this road. It still exists, but it doesn't go anywhere. It wasn't finished. And so it's a kind of model, if you like, for a certain kind of intellectual aesthetic futility. So Green is aware that there are hazards in what he's doing, and he's undercutting them all the time he's doing them. That element of satire, it's a funny book as well as a serious one and a moving one, comes through particularly in the approach to the rich factory-owning family. You remember there's an extraordinary description. I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but thinking about these visual things, there's a description of Mrs. Dupré ringing for the butler at dinner. And there's a, it says, this is on page 30, she pushed button of bell. This was in onyx, it's a semi-precious stone. She laid hand by it on table, and diamonds on her rings glittered together with white metal round onyx button under the electric light. So she's ringing this bell, this beautiful, extraordinary bell with her diamond-encrusted finger, to call the butler. And the reason she's calling the butler is that she sent the footman to look for her handkerchief, but the footman hasn't returned. So now she's calling the butler to get the footman to bring back her handkerchief, when of course it's only just upstairs, she can go and get it or get another one or blow her nose in her napkin or something. We have to do the work of interpretation here, obvious enough though it is, that all that is being paid for, the footman and the butler and the ring and the electric light, by the work that's being done in the factory where Dick Dupré has spent his day before having dinner with them. There's also an intergenerational theme in the hostility between him and his father, and I think throughout the book Green is very alert to the dynamics of family life at every social level. Dick gets a chance to run things, but he doesn't do it any better than anybody has before. People are still afraid for their jobs and lose their jobs, and that affects their lives at home. He's also alert to the differences, not only of class, but of gender in this world, and particularly in working class life. But when Hannah Glossop is upset by the death of her father's chauffeur, the doctor suggests to her mother that she might find some work. Her mother said, "Work? What work would you do?" Well, the doctor said, of course, to be married would be the best thing for her, but in the interim, and of course, in all this, one of the main threads of the story proper is the hopes of Lily Gates. And I'm going to sort of summarize a little bit of plot here because it gets tricky, and even if you've followed it, as I'm sure you have, it won't hurt if I remind you. The first thing is the question which man Lily's going to choose, whether it's Burt Jones or, as her father would prefer, the more family-minded Jim Dale. And there's her feeling of claustrophobia, living at home, keeping house for her widowed father and an old family friend, her own wish to go out to work, an idea which her father, like Hannah Glossop's upper-class mother, thinks is insane. And yet, meanwhile, her father is endlessly grumbling about having to work himself to buy food for her stomach all day and every day. So, you know, he has it both ways. He's always telling her she eats too much. At one point, out in the country with Bert, Lily looks back at the town, and the narrative says she saw with feeling. It's an odd phrase, but the kind of thing that Green does, and if you allow it its meaning, it's a lot to do with how the book sees things, I think. She saw with feeling. She saw in every house was woman with her child. In all streets, in clumps, were children. Here factories were, and more there, in clumps. She saw in her feeling. She saw men working there, all the men and girls, and the two were divided, men from women. And it's this claustrophobia that makes her want to escape to Australia or Canada. And off she goes with Bert. But of course, they get no further than Liverpool. And it's here that the book's frequent references to homing pigeons culminate, I think. Her sense of responsibility to her father and the ailing lodger is too strong for her to press on with the attempt to go. And of course, Bert Jones is himself too inept to provide her with the opportunity anyway. He hasn't even made sure that they've got anywhere to stay there. And here they are lost. They've got nowhere to stay. They haven't got their tickets to Canada. They're on the edge of Britain at Liverpool, ready to get on a boat, but with no means to do it. And the narrative itself cracks at this point. It's on page 189. And I can't remember whether I quoted this bit on the handout. No, page 189. What is a town then? The narrative says. What is a town then? How do I know? What did they do? They went by lamps, lamps, lamps. Houses made the streets. People made the houses. People lived in them. Thousands, millions of lives. They went along through these, strangers to it. And if you follow that passage through, it's extraordinarily wild and all over the place. And I'm quite sure it represents not only an attempt to depict and to live through the confusion and the frustration that Bert and Lily themselves are experiencing, but represents the novelist's own ultimate sense of inability to cross into other people's lives. What is a town then? How do I know? And that issue of the limitations of the individual presses very strongly even at the level of their sense of themselves as selves. Lily, after Bert has just sort of more or less proposed to her, she says, "We shan't be like the others, Bert. We shan't be like the others." It's a question. Are we going to be like the others? And at night she cries to herself, "I," this is page 90, I am I. I am I," she says. But when Dick passes her in the park, almost immediately there in the narrative, he doesn't recognize her, although he's seen her before. And that those kind of engineered little clashes in the narrative between the powerfulness of people's sense of themselves or wish for there to be something of themselves and the reality of the sheer numbers of people and their own individuality is a very important part of what it does. There's a lot more I could say and would like to say. I just want to draw attention to two things. One is the sort of visionary aspects of the book. Its attempt to simultaneously communicate the prosaic and to give it a kind of almost Blakean quality. I've given you a quotation from Ezekiel on the handout. It may seem rather arbitrary, but it's where I think the phrasing about where this bird shall go comes from. There are various references to it, but it's also the epigraph, "As these birds would go, wheresoever would be this child go." There isn't time to pursue that. But the other element which is tucked away in among, or many, that another element which is tucked away among so many others here is the question of the relations not only between people who've lived in a place for a long time, worked in a place for a long time, but also different cultures. Lily tries to go to Canada, doesn't make it. The cinema provides some kind of access to another world. But one day she's out shopping, Lily Gates, it's page 105, and she sees a black man in the street, which was a rare sight in the Britain of those days. She almost turns to look at him, but she's distracted by another intervention from the colonized world in the form of a tea chest in a shop window, which reminds her of a film she's seen of women harvesting tea, presumably in Africa or in India. Now, the moment just hangs there. Nothing is made of it, except that it makes something of itself. It's a striking hint of still other worlds of work and of exploitation beyond Birmingham, beyond Britain. And it's a hint forwards to well, it's a hint out to a kind of writing which Green never attempted because he was interested in his main interests and experience were in other things. But the attempt in fiction to discuss colonization and the impact of colonization, which will be one of our topics next term. I think it's a... I'd be very interested to know what the students in my group have made of this. I know that some of you had difficulties with To the Lighthouse, but it's unmistakably a difficult book. It's one of Green's more difficult books, actually. One of the paradoxes of his career is that whereas Joyce started out writing quite traditionally, but ended up writing about as complicatedly experimentally as could be, Green started out writing experimentally, and by the end of his career was writing kind of social comedy set in the upper classes in Knightsbridge. I'd be interested to know what you make of it, but I hope that you'll agree that whether or not you find it's easy, his work has something quite distinctive to say and to be, and is quite unlike anything by anybody else. Okay, I hope you all have a good break and look forward to seeing you next January.